Something even more terrifying to me is another article, and this also from the San Francisco Chronicle. This one from a few days later, Saturday, April 28th of 1990. And this, again, is by way of review. I concluded the broadcast with this article last week. This is a UPI story, Dateline Orlando, Florida, headlined, Bennett urges taking kids from drug areas. And it reads in part as follows. Federal anti-drug chief William Bennett said yesterday that some neighborhoods are so infested with drugs that children should be removed from them and placed in orphanages. Quote, no one is a stronger proponent of the family than I am, but when we reach the level of child abuse that we see in some parts of America, we've got to do something, unquote, Bennett said. And again quoting, we may just have to find some way to get children out of the environment which they're in, to go to orphanages, to go to boys' towns, to expand institutions like that where they will be raised and nurtured, unquote, he said. There are communities in America right now where children are not being raised at all. There is no positive input in their lives, no nurturing influence, no discipline, Bennett said. He offered no specifics on how to implement his idea. Well, again, as I said last week, I find that very terrifying because relocation, when you have people being relocated from tough areas and taken to points elsewhere, that is reminiscent in many ways of the relocation, quote unquote, of the Jews. Now, during the final solution to the Jewish problem, during Hitler's liquidation of the Jews, it was never stated that the Jews were being taken out and gassed. On the contrary, all the propaganda was being developed that this was an improvement. They were being relocated because the hard conditions in the ghetto, and the Jews were placed under very rigorous economic conditions in the ghetto areas of the city, the parts of the city that they were confined to. The conditions there were made so horrible, particularly with the worsening economy due to the war, that a lot of Jews were, frankly, not that hesitant to be relocated. They figured, what could be worse than this? Well, they found out. Not for very long, but they found out. And the pattern of relocation, quote-unquote, under the final solution varied. In some areas, the children were taken first, and parents were glad to get their kids out because, obviously, the kids were weaker. They were more vulnerable to disease and starvation and so forth, and those conditions were rampant in the ghetto areas. And again, I'm not saying ipso facto this is what's going to happen and this is an exact analogy, but I find it very scary. And when you have a government official talking about taking kids away from their parents in inner city areas and relocating them to orphanages, well, it's ominous to me. And I could see, in the event of an economic collapse, how this could be used as a cover for eliminating sections of the population. Now, it should be noted, too, that one of the aspects of not only the liquidation of the Jews in general, but of the Nazi terror in general, was that as people were eliminated, this created more wealth for those people who were left. As Jews were liquidated, their property was, quote, Aryanized, unquote. That is to say, it was given to Aryans, or it was given to non-Jews. The wealthier people, the owners of banks and so forth, had their businesses turned over to their Aryan compatriots, and more people of more modest means simply had their possessions redistributed. And I myself, I'm not an economist, and I sure hope I'm proven wrong, but I don't see how this country is going to solve its economic problems. We are so in debt, and the things appear so dire to me that I do not see a way out. And one of the things that I'm afraid of is that ultimately the elimination, and it'll be done very quietly, it will not be on page one. They'll have the story about the Goliath frogs on page one, but the papers will not report it. And we're going to talk about Jonestown a little later, something which in some ways I think is horrifyingly analogous to the Bennett proposal. We're going to talk about that later. But it is my fear that some of the social dislocation from an economic crisis will be solved by redistributing black property. There is a black middle class in this country, and the fact of the matter is, through the elimination of a given minority or sections of a minority population, the economic crunch, at least to a certain extent, could be resolved. Basically, if there isn't enough to go around, you reduce the number of people in the population, and then there's more to go around, relatively speaking. This was one of the major Well, it was one of the major elements of the final solution to the Jewish problem, Hitler's liquidation of the Jews, and in general, that the Nazi terror made things more economically comfortable for those people who were left after the killing was done. There's an excellent documentary called The Sorrow and the Pity, done by a French documentary filmmaker called Marcel Aufus, and this deals with France under the Nazi occupation, and in particular with the issue of collaboration. One of the points that's made in that film, and it's an excellent film, well worth seeing, is that many Gentile professionals turned in their Jewish compatriots specifically so they could take over their clientele. If you had a Gentile, a non-Jew, who was a dentist or a doctor or a lawyer, he would turn in his Jewish compatriots and then he would take their clients and make more money. And it really became a very cynical process in certain respects. And again, if this sounds a little extreme to you, we're going to go into some archive shows here, and we're going to take a look at some of the plans or the contingency plans that have been developed in this country. We're going to take a look at an ominous document called the King Alfred Plan, supposedly fictional, but if it's fiction, then this is all fiction, folks, the world meaning, because the King Alfred Plan appears to be real, or appears to have been a real contingency plan. My own feeling is that King Alfred was drawn up by a private right-wing group somewhere in the 1960s, and as the right wing in this country, as the California right, the John Birch Society elements at all, moved into power, and they moved into power with Ronald Reagan, they were moving in before that, basically what had been private right-wing doctrine became official government policy. And I think one need not look very long in America to figure out that that has in fact happened. But again, I think the analogy between the war on drugs and a creeping Rex 84 or a creeping King Alfred is something we should bear in mind. And the dire economic warning signs, I shouldn't say they're on the horizon. I wish they were on the horizon. They're a lot closer than that. Well, they scare me. They scare me not only because I don't like the idea of living in an impoverished society, but I don't think the American people are close to accepting responsibility for their own situation. They will go looking for someone to blame. And in addition to freeing up more wealth and making things more comfortable, the liquidation of certain portions of the population will also give them a chance to blame their problems on others. And that blame, that scapegoating, is already well underway. That's why Reagan can get away with talking about how he's holding down government spending when he's spending more than anyone in previous any one of his predecessors. The fact of the matter is, middle America understands that he's not talking about holding down government spending. He's talking about let's get the niggers. And it was well understood. The meaning of the Willie Horton ploy in the 1988 campaign should not be underestimated, and it should not be mistaken. And again, with the control of the news media here, the compulsive preoccupation of the news media with the sort of jive that I enumerated earlier will play a role. Now, there was a propaganda film made in the Third Reich called Hitler Has Built a City for the Jews, and it basically showed some nice conditions where the Jews were supposed that Jews were supposedly living in, and these nice conditions basically were non-existent. In fact, this was a propaganda film. Some nice conditions, some nice barracks and showers were set up. Jews were shown showering and eating in a very nice mess hall. And then they were taken out and gassed, and the film was shown in German theaters, and people were reassured that, yep, you know, it's real great the way those Jews have been relocated. They don't have to live in those dirty ghettos anymore. Isn't Uncle Addy a real nice guy? In the event of an economic collapse, you may see people being relocated from inner cities, and I guess you could say you will see propaganda films that Bush or Bennett has built a city for the black kids from drug-infested areas. And again, I hope I'm wrong about this. I sure hope I'm wrong. I pray I'm wrong. But I don't think we can afford to take the chance and just trust our fate to, trust our well-being to arbitrary fate. We're going to have to get busy, and I think we're going to have to get busy very soon. It's time now for a discussion of the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan. We talked about that last week. We focused on that heavily in the broadcast this evening. Also bear in mind the information, both the live talk with Ed Connolly, also his very fine article from the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And again, that is available from archives on audio. So, by the way, is Radio Free America 32, if for some reason you're not able to tape it. Now, we're going to go into a discussion of the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan, also the King Alfred plan, and hopefully the information will be self-explanatory. We're going to listen to a little over an hour's worth of material. And by the way, the first voice you will hear here is that of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck.
The first article, detailing in some depth the plan that Dave just alluded to, is from the San Jose Mercury News for July 5th, 1987. The article is headed North and the Secret Government, subheaded Martial Law Plan Among Work of Reagan Advisors. The article is by Alfonso Chardy, who's been doing excellent work, one of the few mainstream journalists who's been really putting out the good stuff on the Iran-Contra scandal. Alfonso Chardy, who writes for the Miami Herald, but this is through the Mercury News Washington Bureau, Dateline Washington. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North helped draft a plan in 1984 to impose martial law in the United States in event of an emergency, inspiring a sharp protest by then-Attorney General William French Smith, according to government officials. The secret plan called for the suspension of the Constitution, turning control of the government over to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and the declaration of martial law in the event of such a crisis as nuclear war, violent and widespread internal dissent, or national opposition to a U.S. military invasion abroad. North's involvement in a proposal to radically alter American government by executive order in a time of crisis is evidence that he was involved in a wide range of secret activities, foreign and domestic, far beyond the Iran-Contra affair, according to officials. The chief counsel of the Senate Iran-Contra Committee has declared in an unreleased memo that North was at the center of what amounted to, quote, a secret government within a government, unquote. Skipping down. The contingency plan was being written as part of an executive order or legislative package that Reagan would sign and hold within the National Security Council until such time as a severe crisis arose, an administration official said. It is not known whether Reagan signed the plan. Investigators now believe that from 1983 to 1986, North's office in the old Executive Office Building, adjacent to the White House, was the heart of an informal secret structure involved in far more than the sale of arms to Iran and the funding of the undercover war in Nicaragua. North's influence within that secret structure was so great, the sources said, that he was able to have the orbits of sophisticated surveillance satellites altered to follow Soviet ships around the world, call for the launching of high-flying spy aircraft on secret missions over Cuba and Nicaragua, and become involved in sensitive domestic activities. Some of Reagan's closest friends and advisors, including former National Security Advisor William Clark, the late CIA Director William Casey, and Attorney General Edwin Meese, were part of that informal secret structure, according to several congressional investigators and government officials. Skipping down. But according to the sources, the administration's propensity for secret activities may have had its beginnings in an October 1980 decision by Casey, then Reagan's campaign manager, to create a so-called October Surprise Group to monitor President Jimmy Carter's feverish negotiations with Iran for the release of 52 American hostages. The group, led by campaign foreign policy advisor Richard Allen, was founded out of concern that Carter might pull off an October surprise, such as a last-minute deal for release of the hostages before the November 4th election. One of the group's first acts was a meeting with a man who claimed to represent Iran and who offered to release the hostages to Reagan. Allen and another campaign aide, Lawrence Silberman, in April told the Miami Herald of the meeting and said that McFarlane, then a Senate Armed Services Committee aide, arranged and attended it. McFarlane later became Reagan's National Security Advisor and in 1986 played a key role in the Iran-Contra affair. Allen and Silberman said the offer, which they said they rejected, was aimed at ensuring Reagan's victory. Congressional investigators now link another well-known campaign incident, the theft of confidential briefing materials from Carter's campaign before the October 28, 1980 Carter-Reagan debate, to the same secret group. The investigators now believe that Casey somehow obtained the materials used to brief Reagan on what Carter was likely to say and passed them to James Baker, another top Reagan campaign aide who in Reagan's first term served as White House Chief of Staff. Okay, so what we're talking about here, the plan, which as we'll see, later came to be known as Rex 84, was a plan put together by, among other people, Oliver North, William Clark, Edwin Meese, and Bill Casey, the late Bill Casey, of course, who's not around anymore to talk about his part of the affair, and was planned to go into effect under a number of circumstances, but the most interesting for our purpose are the one, widespread internal dissent, and B, specifically political opposition to an invasion by U.S. military forces. Again, the Reagan administration, being the kind of folks that they are, have learned some lessons, and one of the lessons they learned was how an outraged populace could gum up the works for a lovely military adventure like Vietnam. And the Reagan administration, if they were going to go to war with Nicaragua, was not going to have to put up with such irritations as dissent at home and the free expression of political opposition.
It's worth noting, too, because one of the things that we discussed at the end of Radio Free America number 30, our first program on the terror connections, was a plan. First of all, we talked about the La Penca bombing itself, in which Aidan Pastora, who, although he was opposed to the Sandinistas, was equally opposed to the Contra factions themselves, primarily because of the fact that their leadership were all the former Somocistas, and in large measure due to the fact that he refused to cooperate with the CIA, members of the secret team apparently set off a bomb, because I say apparently because it has not yet been settled in American court, but they set off a bomb in an attempt to kill Aidan Pastora that was initially blamed on the Sandinistas and was to be used, was being used as yet another piece of propaganda to make that regime look bad. One of the things that we spoke about also at the end of Radio Free America number 30 was a proposed plan by this same secret team to blow up the U.S. Embassy to Costa Rica, killing the United States ambassador to that country, Louis Tams, himself a collaborator with many members of the secret team, and then blaming that on the Sandinistas and using that as an excuse to invade Nicaragua. One of the things that emerged during the public hearings this past spring and summer was that Oliver North also had envisioned what he called an Alamo scenario, to get the Contras involved in a big battle where they would lose a lot of men, they would take heavy casualties, this again to instigate an overt U.S. military invasion of Nicaragua. Had there been widespread public opposition to that invasion, and there are strong indications that there would be, more than 70% of the population of this country opposes Contra aid, then the Oliver North scenario to institute martial law would have been placed in effect. Now, martial law and the Reagan administration are two things that are not strangers to one another. One of the things that we focused on in considerable measure in Radio Free America number 23 was the apparent deliberate use of terrorism when Ronald Reagan was governor of California in order to do just this sort of thing, to drive popular political sentiment to the right and to create a social and political environment conducive to the institution of police state tactics. Many of the terrorist incidents which plagued California under the Reagan administration, notably the Symbionese Liberation Army, appear to have, in fact, been put together by the national security establishment and the police in order to effect a right-wing takeover, if you will. Among the plans that were worked on by members of the Reagan gubernatorial administration, who later moved up into the Reagan presidential administration, was the Operation Cable Splicer and Operation Garden Plot, which were the California and national scenarios, respectively, for the institution of martial law in the United States in the event of widespread domestic disturbance. Many of the same people involved with the California plans moved up with Ronald Reagan into Washington, D.C., and were involved with the planning and possible execution of Rex 84. Rex 84 is the formal name for this martial law plan, and we're going to review some information that we presented in our last broadcast on the subject. This is the description of Rex 84 as it comes from the Sheehan affidavit. The Sheehan affidavit is Daniel Sheehan's affidavit, he being the point man at the present time for the Christic Institute, a public interest law firm who is filing suit on behalf of Tony Avergan and Martha Honey
the victim and wife of the victim from the Lapenka bombing. Reading now from the Sheehan affidavit. At the end of March of 1984, I communicated to sources number 4, 5, and 6, and 7, the information communicated to me earlier in March by Protestant minister source number 1, and I asked them to ascertain for me the source of this accusation that the Catholic Church participants in the sanctuary movement were somehow involved in smuggling into the United States known communist terrorists, unquote, who planned to form themselves once inside the United States into military cadres to undertake the launching of military assaults against U.S. military installations, domestic communication centers, and domestic water resource systems in the event that President Reagan deemed it necessary to initiate direct military action by U.S. forces in Central America, either in El Salvador or in Nicaragua. During the second week of April of 1984, I was informed by source number 4 that President Ronald Reagan had, on April 6 of 1984, issued National Security Decision Directive number 52, authorizing Federal Emergency Management Agency Director Louis O. Giuffrida, G-I-U-F-F-R-I-D-A, and his deputy Frank Salcedo, S-A-L-C-E-D-O, to undertake a secret nationwide readiness exercise codenamed Rex 84. This exercise was to test the readiness, unquote, of the Federal Emergency Management Agency to exercise civilian supervisory authority over Defense Department personnel, the personnel of all 50 state National Guard units, and numerous state-based state defense force units, which were to be established at the behest of FEMA by state legislative enactments, in the event that President Reagan chose to declare a, quote, a state of domestic national emergency, concurrent with the launching of a direct United States military operation into Central America. This military operation was to be codenamed Operation Night Train. According to source number 4, the mission of the FEMA operation to be tested pursuant to this Rex 84 readiness exercise was twofold. First, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, after deputizing all Department of Defense personnel and state National Guard personnel, ostensibly so as to make such personnel civilians and to thereby avoid violating the congressionally enacted Posse Comitatus Act, would undertake to test its ability to seek out and to take into custody some 400,000 undocumented Central American aliens throughout the United States, and then to intern said Central American aliens in 10 military detention centers to be established during this Rex 84 readiness exercise at 10 U.S. military bases throughout the United States. I would take note there of the fact that there were to be 10 military bases and detention centers throughout the United States. We'll touch on that later. These documented Central American aliens were to be held at these detention centers during any real such presidentially deemed state of domestic national emergency without the right of habeas corpus until President Reagan declared the state of national emergency to be at an end. This second mission of the FEMA operation to be tested pursuant to this Rex 84 readiness exercise was the distribution by FEMA from U.S. military bases under the supervision of the United States Department of Defense through the state National Guard units down into the hands of the civilian state legislature-created state defense forces of hundreds of tons of small arms and ammunition, ostensibly to be used by their civilian law enforcement deputies to enforce domestic laws during the pending of the presidentially declared state of national emergency.
Continuing a little further down in the Sheehan affidavit. During the third week of April of 1984, source number 7 obtained for me an introduction to source 8, a member of the legal division of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the office headed up by FEMA General Counsel George Delt. Source 8, who was known by Source 7 to be an honest and trustworthy source of information based upon Source 7's direct experience with him, was shocked that I had such accurate information concerning the content of Presidential National Security Decision Directive number 52. But he expressly confirmed the accuracy of the intelligence report given to me by Source 4 concerning the twofold mission of Rex 84. Source 8 expressed directly to me a high degree of fear and anxiety about the legality of what was being planned by FEMA General Counsel George Jett, FEMA Director Louis O. Giuffrida, and FEMA Deputy Director Frank Salcedo. Source 8 reported to me that he had never before seen inside FEMA such an intense level of security concerning any program. Source 8 reported to me that FEMA General Counsel George Jett had ordered the installation of a special metal security door into the hallway on the fifth floor of the FEMA building in Washington, D.C., behind which door all of the planning for Rex 84 was being conducted. Indeed, Source 8 reported to me that even long-standing employees of the Civil Defense Division of the Federal Executive Department, possessing the highest possible security clearances, were not being allowed through the newly installed metal security door on the fifth floor of the FEMA building to have access to the planning of Rex 84. Source 8 reported that only FEMA Director Louis O. Gifreda, his Deputy Director Frank Salcedo, FEMA General Counsel George Jett, spelled J-E-T-T, and a few other men whom Source 8 noticed all wore a small red Christian cross or crucifix pin on the lapel of their suits were even allowed through the metal security doors on the fifth floor of the FEMA building to have access to Rex 84. Through a source number 9, I was able to obtain a series of federal documents from inside FEMA, which tended to confirm the above-reported description of the FEMA activities reported to me during April of 1984.
In early May of 1984, I was supplied by source number 4 with a number of documents describing in some detail a project supervised by then Special Assistant California State Attorney General Edwin Meese, codenamed Project Cable Splicer. This project, undertaken by Edwin Meese under the direction of then-California Governor Ronald Reagan, took then-California Organized Crime Training Institute Commandant Louis O. Gifreda from his post in San Luis Obispo and made him the commanding general of the California State National Guard. At the California Organized Crime Training Institute, Commandant Louis Gifreda had been the instructor in civil disorder control. As commanding general of the California State National Guard, Louis Gifreda coordinated Project Cable Splicer for Special Assistant Attorney General Edwin Meese and Governor Ronald Reagan. Project Cable Splicer was a special war games readiness exercise, pursuant to which Governor Reagan, Special Assistant Attorney General Edwin Meese, and California State National Guard Commander Gifreda could, together, establish an effective state of statewide martial law, quote, in the event that forces of radical black nationalism joined forces inside the state of California with the anti-Vietnam forces to challenge the established authority of the state, unquote. Project Cable Splicer was part of a larger program codenamed Operation Garden Plot, which was a nationwide war game scenario prepared by then-President Richard M. Nixon and his Attorney General John Mitchell, designed to establish a nationwide state of martial law if Richard Nixon's political enemies required him to declare a state of national emergency. And in a section called State Defense Forces and a Guns for Contra Scam, Sheehan continues, in mid-May of 1984, I was informed by source number 10, who is a professional journalist in New Orleans, Louisiana, that he had learned that the state legislatures of Louisiana, Alabama, and Texas had sometime around April 1984 or May of 1984 each passed legislation establishing units known as state defense forces, unquote. Source number 10 informed me that he was extremely concerned about this because the only people in Louisiana, Alabama, or Texas who seemed to have heard of the passage of these statutes and who were therefore signing up to join these state defense forces were ultra-right-wing paramilitary survivalist types or soldiers of fortune types who were being advised to sign up for these state defense force units at weekend survivalist training centers or ultra-right war game schools. Source number 10 informed me that this concern on his part had caused him to undertake an investigation to ascertain what was going on regarding the state defense force units in Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas. Source number 10 informed me that he had discovered that a group of men in Texas who had all signed up for the Texas units had been expelled by the Texas National Guard for being too radically right-wing. This investigation led him to a Louisiana State National Guard colonel, source number 11. Source number 10 informed me that this Louisiana State National Guard colonel had informed source number 10 that the State Defense Force unit in Louisiana was, in the near future, this being in May of 1984, going to be receiving a large quantity of small arms and ammunition in some kind of war game activity supervised by the federal government, but that the State Defense Force in Louisiana was only going to have to give back half of the arms and ammunition received in the war games. The half which were left with them were going to be smuggled over out of the country to the Contras in Central America. Well, that, in a nutshell, is this Rex 84 readiness exercise, the martial law plan that was being readied by this administration. There are a number of chilling things about it. Simply the picture of men with a small red crucifix pin in their lapel, huddling together under circumstances so clandestine that not even the other members of the Federal Emergency Management Agency were permitted to be privy to their secrets, is chilling enough. The thought of taking Ku Klux Klansmen, Nazis, and types of that type, individuals of that type, and deputizing them, having them act in an official American, in an official capacity as agents of the U.S. government, is chilling enough. It would be less chilling if it were not something which unfortunately had an all too clear precedent in the American past. One of the things we spoke about in our four-part series about the evolution of the American far right, which we called the Aryan Nations, was in fact what we called the establishment of de facto Freikorps units in the United States, that we examined Ku Klux Klan and Nazi elements in this country in the past as operating as federal intelligence agents and police agents, and we speculated basically that many of the ultra-right-wing groups, such as elements of the Klan, the Nazi Party, the John Birch Society, were in fact operating as a Freikorps, as an underground extension of the U.S. national security establishment, in much the way that the organized murder gangs of the German army in the early 20s systematically eliminated the democratic leadership of Germany, paving the way for Hitler's rise to power. And at the conclusion of our four-part Aryan Nation series, at the end of Radio Free America number 13, we took a look at the Reagan administration as what we termed the ultimate exponent of Freikorps methodology, and specifically took a look at Oliver North and his use of elements of the World Anti-Communist League and other institutions, which could be described as explicitly fascist in order to further the aims of the U.S. of U.S. national policy.
Indeed, and speaking a little bit more of Oliver North and his particular foreign policy aims and the aims of those like him, a well-written piece by Alexander Coburn appeared in These Times for July 22, 1987. This particular article was provided to us by Mae Brussel. The article is titled Homegrown Fascist. I believe it also appeared in some other publications, notably The Nation. Homegrown Fascist, Alexander Coburn. Oliver North is a true memento of the Reagan era, and indeed of the president himself. He has Reagan's own capacity for the vibrant lie, uttered with such conviction that it is evident that formidable psychic mechanisms of self-validation have in that instant convinced the liar, Reagan, North, that what he is saying is true. But on display last week in Congress was something more disturbing than a mere deceiver. The cocksure, edgy, ingratiating profile of an all-America 80s-style fascist. The fascist has absolute moral assurance that his lawlessness is lawful, that though he, quote, gets things done, he is following orders, that all impediments in his path, legal or moral, are obstructions erected by hostile conspiracy. Colonial wars are notable forcing beds for the development of the fascist personality, particularly if such wars end in defeat for the colonial or imperial power. France's defeats in Vietnam and Algeria enriched the already muscular tradition of Gallic fascism, and, in a different idiom, the U.S. defeat in Vietnam produced a crop of officers brooding on the, quote, stab in the back by effete civilians at home. It is entirely characteristic that North should have been part of a team drafting a secret plan to run the country by martial law. This phase of his activities occurred between 1982 and 1984, according to stories, particularly in Knight Ritter's papers, based on material developed by the Iran-Contra Committee staff. North's first assignment at the National Security Council in 1981 had been to carry the, quote, football, the briefcase carrying the plans for fighting a nuclear war that accompanies the president wherever he goes. Those who like thinking about the unthinkable might ponder this parable of impending nuclear disaster. A president who has frequently expressed the view that the, quote, apocalypse may occur, quote, in our lifetime, trailed by the football-carrying North with his own history of mental instability. In the following 2 years, North was the NSC's liaison with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, revising contingency plans to deal with nuclear war, insurrection, or major military mobilization. North and the FEMA folk settled down happily to develop scenarios of total control. FEMA's director at the time, Louis Jafrida, had attended Army War College in Pennsylvania in 1970 and written there a paper advocating martial law in case of a national uprising by black militants, along with roundup and transfer to, quote, assembly centers or relocation camps, unquote, of at least 21 million American Negroes, unquote. This paper was reworked in a 1982 memo written by Jafrida's deputy, John Brinkerhoff, at which time North and the FEMA team developed their plan for a secret contingency order, turning control of the country over to FEMA at any time of nuclear war, violent dissent, or, most significantly, national opposition to a military invasion abroad. FEMA would supervise appointment of military commanders to run state and local government. In other words, while North's colleagues at the National Security Council were preparing the invasion of Nicaragua, North was working on a scheme to introduce martial law in the U.S. as a means of crushing any internal opposition to that invasion when it took place.
Now, one of the things that is most disturbing, obviously there are a lot of things that are disturbing about this contingency plan. The notion of interning 21 million black Americans in concentration camps, or, quote, relocation camps, as they have been euphemized since the time of Hitler, is certainly very ominous. Coburn refers to that in that particular column. Interestingly enough, the plan for rounding up a large portion, if not virtually all, of the black people in this country and interning them in concentration camps was left out of the July 5th San Jose Mercury News article by Alfonso Chardy. Research credit on the following article goes to Mae Russell once again. Mae obtained the original Miami Herald story from that upon which the Mercury story was ostensibly based. It was based on it, but regrettably, the Mercury left out some of the most chilling parts. Once again, research credit to Mae Russell. This is from the Miami Herald of Sunday, July 5th of 1987. It's by Alfonso Chardy, and it's headlined, Reagan AIDS and the Secret... Reagan AIDS and the Secret Government. That's the title. And again, this is by Alfonso Chardy. We're going to read the section of the original Miami Herald article, or part of the section, one of the sections that was left out by the San Jose Mercury. In the original Miami Herald article, the following information was printed that the Mercury did not print. Speaking of the Rex 84 martial law plan, the official said the contingency plan was written as part of an executive order or legislative package that Reagan would sign and hold within the NSC until a severe crisis arose. The martial law portions of the plan were outlined in a June 30, 1982 memo by Jufrida's Deputy for National Preparedness Programs, John Brinkerhoff, B-R-I-N-K-E-R-H-O-F-F. A copy of the memo was obtained by the Herald. The scenario outlined in the Brinkerhoff memo resembled somewhat a paper Jufrida had written in 1970 at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in which he advocated martial law in case of a national uprising by black militants. The paper also advocated the roundup and transfer to, quote, assembly centers or relocation camps, unquote, of at least 21 million American Negroes. Well, this on these broadcasts, this is not a scenario that is entirely foreign to us. There is an archive program that we have placed available from archives on audio called the King Alfred Plan. If we've ever done a more controversial broadcast, I can't think of it. We're now going to go into the King Alfred Plan, unquote, and I think it would be worthwhile perhaps for me to explain a little bit about the background. In 1967, there was a novel published called The Man Who Cried I Am, authored by a man named John Williams. Incidentally, the hardcover edition was published, copyright 1967, by Little Brown and Company. Now, this book is a novel, though it's obviously a very realistic one. Near the end of the novel, a man, the protagonist, comes across a plan for the elimination of all black Americans in the event of just the sort of scenario we saw there, what they call a national emergency or an uprising by the minority, as they euphemize black Americans, the situation here. There was a plan outlined in this novel by the National Security Council to basically, it could be termed a final solution to the Negro problem, quote-unquote. They plan for the interning and, reading between the lines, the elimination of all black Americans. Although the book itself is a novel, eventually the actual document or a document, called the King Alfred Plan, began to be circulated among certain researchers. The document is identical in every respect to the document published in the novel, except for a file number at the bottom of the second page. Also, the placing of a footnote in the actual document, the copy which has made it, its way to researchers, is placed differently than the document as portrayed in the hardbound edition. The softcover edition, which I don't have in front of me, did place the footnote in the same place. It should be noted that both the hardcover and softcover editions had this document over several different pages. The copy that made its way to researchers was on two long Xerox sheets. The network of personal associations that got this to us is one which we trust quite a bit. Mae Brussel, whose work is featured on this station and who has provided a lot of our research in the past, was the person who sent me this document. And I'll repeat some of the story about how this came to me. Among the many things that convinced us to go with this particular story was that when Mae sent me the King Alfred Plan, two copies were intercepted in the mail and never arrived at all. A third took the better part of 2 weeks to arrive from Carmel. And it just, for those of you who eventually hear this program outside of California, it does not take 2 weeks for a piece of mail to get from Carmel to San Jose.
You could jog from Carmel to San Jose in less than 2 weeks, yeah.
And I've handled a lot of correspondence with Mae, and Nip and I have gotten a lot of things through the mail. We had never received anything under such extraordinary conditions. Plus, Mae knew the person who provided her with this document very, very well, and the person assured her that, in fact, the King Alfred Plan was a real scenario. This was an actual copy of the document which John Williams put in his novel because the publisher would not allow him to say that this was a real document. Many researchers have taken us to task since for having, quote, been gullible, unquote. It should be noted that this is a real document. It is within the realm of possibility, and we acknowledge that this could be some sort of clever forgery issued by someone for whatever reason. However, the document itself appears to be real. I personally think that this is, in fact, the King Alfred Plan, that is in fact a real, the actual national security contingency plan for the elimination of black Americans. It should be noted later that after we put the King Alfred Plan archive show on file, one of our listeners on the East Coast, who's a computer whiz, obtained from a data bank an interesting document which would indicate, in fact, that the King Alfred Plan is, as it has been represented to us, and as May's confidant maintained it was, an actual copy of the National Security Contingency Plan. We're then going to read you this document, and then we're going to ruminate about Rex 84 in light of the King Alfred Plan.
The document obtained, not the King Alfred Plan itself, but the seemingly correlative document, is something that came out under the masthead of the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction for the state of Ohio, and it's a publications not to be permitted in the institutions list for the Department of Corrections.
You might want to read them the actual case. This is pursuant to a law case. Just read them the case in the appendix for people who, that might be how it's referenced in the data bank.
Okay. It's the case is Taylor versus Perini, P-E-R-I-N-I, Taylor spelled T-A-Y-L-O-R. Taylor versus Perini, cite as 413 F supplemental, I guess, S-U-P-P, period 189, dated 1976, Appendix E, and it's a document, Department of Rehabilitation's Corrections document, and it's headed Publications Not to be Permitted in the Institutions, and you go down and it's got a lot of things like a swinging publication called The Dawn of Aquarius and Black Dragon Fighting Society and all kinds of gay magazines and martial arts things and things of that sort, and some political things, Inez Garcia Defense Committee, a few other things like that, and then right down there, number 29, it says King Alfred - National Security Council. Now, of course, this could just mean that the same document that we obtained is been floating around in the prison system, and that it's that still doesn't make it true, but it certainly means that it exists. It's not something that's been cobbled together to be sent just to researchers. It's around. It exists. The Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections is somewhat understandably concerned that prisoners in Ohio at least don't get their hands on it, sitting there in prison all day with nothing to think about except the fact that what the government might have in mind for them. So, again, that is the a citation of it under the masthead of the Ohio Department of Corrections.